revolution. Well, you know, we all want to change the world. When you talk about destruction, don't you know you can count me in, out, in, out. Be all right, be all right, be all right. See, you got a resolution. Well, you know, we have love to see the flag. You ask for a contribution. One money people mind that, hey, I'll tell you, brother, have to wait. Be all right, be all right, be all right. Want to change the Constitution? Well, you know, they don't want to change your head. They act as an institution. Well, you know, better free your mind instead. Go kind, pick your chairman, Mal. Gonna make an error anyhow.
Okay, here we go. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. So we're going to be talking about a subject that I've been dealt with a number of times in the past with Deborah Schwarzkopf, who, as I said, is going to be in town at the Montevilla United Methodist Church tonight for a meeting on putting a stop to shock, a major legal victory. And we've got on the phone Michael Sturman, who himself suffered, as a young man, suffered many electroshock treatments and suffered the results of which, of that, and those results are the what was the subject of a major lawsuit in California that was just decided on the side of the patients. A settlement was made, I'm not sure the terms of that. I'm not sure they're known, but we'll be talking with Michael Sturman about that. He'll be also at this event this evening in Portland at the Montevilla United Methodist Church, 7 to 9 p.m. And we're trying to get my other guest, David Potter. So headphones working.
They're working now.
They're working now. Okay, we're all together. And David Potter is a member of Rethinking Psychiatry. And so we'll continue that. So let's see if Michael is on the line with us. Michael, hello.
Hello.
Sorry about that confusion here. Sometimes we have technical difficulties. So, yeah, why don't you start out before we talk a little more about this event this evening, which you will, as I said, be at. Talk a little bit about your own personal history, if you would.
Yes. When I was 16, I was committed by my parents to a state hospital, and this was a long time ago. This was in 1960, and I was forced to undergo between 20 and 30 bilateral electroshock treatments, and I experienced being unable to breathe and unable to move, and extreme fears of dying during this procedure. And later I learned that probably what happened was I was not put to sleep as I should have been first, as they usually do in all surgical procedures, so you don't experience extreme pain. But they gave me the muscle relaxant, which at that time they used Nectin or succinylcholine chloride, which paralyzes all of the muscles, including the diaphragm, which is the muscle which pumps the lungs. And consequently, I had recurrent painful thoughts and nightmares, and now it's almost 60 years later, and I still think about it every day. It was such a traumatic experience in my life, and I could only hope that in the future nothing like this will happen again. And just last year I was reading in Peter Bagan's book on electroshock treatment that there is a minority of psychiatrists who do electroshock this way, but that most electroshock psychiatrists do not approve of it.
Don't approve of what?
Not putting people to sleep before giving them a muscle relaxant.
And, well, let me just jump forward. There's a lot of different aspects to this, but I imagine that the practitioners of electroshock, the current modalities of electroshock would possibly respond by saying that the technologies and the techniques have changed dramatically, you know, beyond just the, you know, putting people to sleep or not, but even the dose, the amount of current being used and such. How would you respond to that?
Well, yes, they have changed. There is, at that time, they were using bilateral electroshock, and now it's more often unipolar. But I understand most still prefer the old way, bipolar. And it would seem to me that this was a willful act, that the doctor would have to give the muscle relaxant first. And that's the way I experienced it. I was given a shot in my vein, in my arm, and within seconds I experienced the respiratory paralysis.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't think... you know, if a doctor wants to do something like that and he can get away with it, it's possible that it's still going on. I don't know. I would hope not.
Mm-hmm. And so you're going to be talking with Deborah Schwarzkopf this evening at, as I said, at United Methodist Church. It's actually going to have David Potter, our other guest. Why don't you say hello, David?
Hey, Paul and everybody.
Good morning. Good morning. I was going to have you talk about this, but I kind of got thrown off by that beginning there. So, what are you all going to be talking about this evening?
Well, we've got Deborah and Michael to tell us all about their victory and the ongoing work. Deborah, of course, has her website, ECT Justice, or Electroconvulsive Therapy Justice, which is sort of the fancy jargony way talking about electroshock. And we're also, it's a celebration. I mean, I believe we're going to have cake and streamers and, you know, kind of a party atmosphere. This is like a big victory in a realm that in which these are, you know, so sort of few and far between, the victories. So.
Yeah, so we'll have you talk a little bit more about this court case, Michael. Maybe you could talk about do you have any relationship to that particular court case?
No, I don't. Deborah is the one who is knowledgeable about that. I'm glad to see it, though. I think something needs to be done to stop the practice because so many people are reporting brain damage and problems associated with it. And I myself experienced a diminution, reduction in my intellectual functioning, and I returned to school after my hospitalization, and previously I had been a nearly all A honors student, and then I was struggling just to get by. And the most outstanding problem I had was difficulties saying simple things due to not being able to find common words, which is a symptom of aphasia, which frequently follows strokes and other types of brain damage. And I went to great lengths to regain my talking skills. I made over 1,000 cassette tapes, and I would redo them until I was satisfied, more or less. And fortunately, I was able to recover my speech functioning and my academic functioning, But I understand there are many who are permanently disabled in so many ways, and it's really a glaring a tragedy, and something needs to be done. The profession has not even gone so far as to research how many people actually have a brain damage due to electric shock that is long-lasting. Mm-hmm. And the best estimates are maybe 25 to over 50%, but this is just an estimate. We definitely need to know, because if the risk is 50%, then there's no sense in going on with electric shock, or even if it's 25 and there are vulnerable groups like persons under 18, it definitely has to be regulated much better than it is now.
Yet, and you know, when you say 25 to 50%, and then makes you wonder how many people have actually received this so-called treatment over the years. Do you have any idea if there's any numbers on how many people have actually received it?
Well, Dr. Vagan, in his book, Electroshock Disabling Effects, estimated over 100,000 in the United States each year. So that would add up to millions and millions. And remarkably, the thing is, electroshock is now undergoing a revival in the U.S., where we're on a fee-for-service payment plan, where doctors receive a certain fee for their service, while in the U.K., which has a socialized medicine and doctors are on salary, a fixed salary, it's gone down very, very substantially. So it's been seen as risky and unnecessary, because there are now so many alternatives in terms of drugs or psychotherapy. So it just becomes a greater and greater tragedy in this country all the time. And I am so glad to hear about this lawsuit, and I hope it leads to much better things in the future.
Well, I'm going to, in a little bit, I'm going to read a little bit from this article by Peter Bragan about that, just came out about a month ago. But, you know, it's because there hasn't been really any significant research or compiling of or any databases on the exact number of people and the amount of damage, the amount and kind of damage mm-hmm. they've had. It's hard to know whether, you know, you say in the note you wrote me, you said you went on and got a bachelor's and master's degree into practice, clinical psychology for over 30 years. So, you know, you obviously, with a lot of will and effort on your part, able to overcome the damage that was done, but it's hard to know whether you are one of the lucky ones, whether, you know, how common it is for people to be able to, you know, because because there's very little information and data compiled on it, but also because what you wrote next, that you were afraid to openly discuss your experience, fearing that it might have repercussions at work or in your social life. So there's the shame, well, and the fear. And so there's a lot of, it's a very insidious thing, this electroshock. It's got such a stigma that it's almost the perfect. Go ahead.
It's like persons with AIDS. In the places where I work, their information was regarded with ultra confidentiality. We weren't even allowed to mention in any psychological reports that we wrote, where we normally would indicate the type of medical illnesses that they had. And it's, of course, not as bad as AIDS, but I just wonder, people think in terms of stereotypes. Somebody had electroshock, someone was at a state hospital. Wow, everything they do, you know, is considered in a new light, in a very negative light. And people are looking at you like they had a magnifying glass and they could see into your head. Of course, they don't. And they can very easily come to biased and wrong conclusions. And that
We're hearing the dial
Hello?
Tone.
Hello?
Heather, we're hearing the dial tone over the air.
Oh, sorry.
No, that was I think on our end. Go ahead.
Well, I was just saying, just to take precautions, I didn't discuss it. And also, it's very embarrassing, of course, to have something like that happen to you. And even if, let's say, someone has cancer, it's often they're warned not to discuss it with their employer because it may have implications as far as their health insurance and costs to the employer for health benefits. So I think I did the right thing there. And at the same time, I'm very concerned about the profession and it's going on with electroshock treatment, and in particular with individuals who would do something like was done to me and get away with it. And no legal precaution, no legal repercussions or professional repercussions occur. And I know the doctor who did it, and he went right on. He went into private practice, and he probably made loads of money. And here I was left with this tremendous trauma and the difficult chore of overcoming what shouldn't have happened in the first place. And so, it's to speak of it very bluntly, it was criminal.
Well, that's why it's important that this lawsuit happened, because it seems like now they're. This was not against any doctor, any actual practitioner of these mm-hmm. so-called treatments, but is against a manufacturer. Let me just read. I'm speaking with Michael Sturman on the phone, who was coming up to Portland to be in an event this evening called Putting a Stop to Shock, a Major Legal Victory. That's this evening, 7 to 9 p.m. at Montevilla United Methodist Church. That's at 232 Southeast 80th Avenue. And you can go to our this program page, Wednesday Talk Radio, at kbo.fm and get all the information about that and more. The number to call in, 503-231-8187. I just want to get a couple paragraphs in here so you really know more about what it is we're actually talking about. This is by Peter Bragan on the website Mad in America. A long-awaited major electroconvulsive therapy case that was on the eve of trial just settled to the satisfaction of the injured ECT patients and the DK Law Group by trial attorney David Karen in California. While the settlement amount remains confidential, as an expert in the case, I am pleased to report, this is Peter Bragan saying, that this resolved litigation is a significant victory. The evidence secured has paved the way for more suits against ECT manufacturers that are on the way. The lawsuit against the ECT manufacturer had its critical breakthrough when the California judge recently allowed the case to proceed to jury trial after their motion for summary judgment was denied. The judge's decision has effectively established the methodology for bringing this and other lawsuits against ECT manufacturers for their failure to warn of known or knowable risks of brain damage caused by ECT. And it goes on for another couple pages, and this is a link to also on the program page for this program at kbo.fm. And Peter Bragan is a longtime advocate against psychiatric abuse. He himself is a psychiatrist, and he has written a number of books, including that book on electroshock. And he's an expert witness in this case. It's very fascinating. It's really his summaries. It's a very insider's look at this case. So anybody who's particularly interested in this issue, in psychiatric rights issues, in all sorts of issues around mental health, is worth checking this out. This is kind of on the cutting edge, I think, of the movement. Because it's been so hard to make a dent in the whole use of electroshock, especially since it's coming back and it's sort of been repackaged as a kinder, friendlier version of electroshock. Okay, so David, do we have any callers? Oh, I got Sean on line two. Well, let's just go to Sean. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning. Paul, I want to thank your guests for their very important work. My grandfather was in what I guess could best be described as a snake pit from 1952 to about 1967, Elgin State Hospital outside of Chicago. And so I grew up hearing all the horror stories about the old mental hospitals. When I was 15 in 87, I myself became very depressed, and I was hospitalized in an adolescent psychiatric hospital. And I had a very different experience. Both my parents, they were divorced, but they both belonged to strong labor unions. And so I received excellent psychiatric care that had very little emphasis on medication. It's nothing like ECT or anything like that. It was mostly talk therapy, individual and group. My question for your two guests today is, in their opinions, do they think that, in essence, we've thrown out the baby with the bathwater? It seems to be that, like, our homeless population, you know, there's a significant percentage that suffer from mental illness, and they would benefit greatly from well-run, well-funded psychiatric hospitals. But it seems like the upper middle class and wealthy people view asylums as the old snake pits, when poor people would benefit greatly from well-run, well-funded psychiatric hospitals. Thanks. Well,
I would say what homeless people might benefit from primarily would be housing. I mean, I think, you know, anybody who... Just imagine being on the street, getting little sleep, et cetera, et cetera. That could make anybody, you know, quote, crazy. So before we put people in hospitals and start selling drugs to the public and earning profits for the pharmaceutical companies, or selling electroshock treatments, because I think that's what drives this industry primarily, we should step back and say, well, what happens if you just give people the health care of housing? Well, now, that may not solve all of them, but I think that could easily account for half of
and support
guess,
and support networks around that too.
That's what networks,
the most cutting edge programs have.
Indeed.
Put them in housing and then have all the medical and whatever support that's needed, yeah.
Right, and our show, we do a monthly event. This is a monthly thing on the first Wednesday on different topics. And last month, we had a person who is beginning the training. It's going to be a training throughout next year on a number of weekends through the year for people in this field in a training in open dialogue. Now, open dialogue was pioneered and is still practiced, is the primary state mental health modality in Western Lapland in Finland. And this open dialogue method, which totally de-emphasizes drugs, rarely used, also de-emphasizes hospitals. They send practitioners out in pairs to work with people in their homes, with their families, in front of them. They always discuss everything in a group, in public. So there's just vastly different. It's about respect. It's about openness. It's about not traumatizing people and telling them that they're broken and they're never going to get fixed and they better take all these drugs and nonsense like that. That system, the open dialogue method, which has been operated in Finland for in Lapland for 20 to 25 years, has the best outcomes in the world for psychosis, so-called psychosis.
Oh, specifically psychosis?
Yeah. I believe that's the emphasis I'm not an expert on the precise boundaries of that claim.
Well, it's just a general invitation for people to come out to these monthly Rethinking Psychiatry events, which last month, as David said, was on the open dialogue. This month is on putting a stop to shock, a major legal victory at Montevilla United Methodist Church this evening at 7 p.m. And go and meet people. And if you yourself have struggled, are struggling with any mental health issues, emotional health issues that are making it difficult for you to survive in this extremely difficult, competitive, profit-oriented world, which I think is the basis, really, for our problems. And so we should all together struggle together to end the profit system as a way to solve our problems. That's my view. But anyway, we're talking specifically about ECT, electroconvulsive therapy. That therapy, yeah. Some therapy. Anyway, or otherwise known as electric shock, which of course, you know, it's, I guess it's kind of dated now, but One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest really gave a very stark image to that. That might have been, that movie, you know, maybe single-handedly actually kind of brought a lot of things out into the open that and may have led to a number of changes, possibly. But anyway, we're talking with David Potter in the studio, who's a member of Rethinking Psychiatry, and Michael Sturman on the phone. And the number to call in and join the conversation is 503-231-8187. That's the number to call in. Michael, talk, you know, so you said you know, this whole issue of being afraid to openly discuss your experience, I mean, that must have been, made it difficult to, you know, compare and contrast your experience with other people's. How long did it take you to actually start, you know, meeting people who had undergone also undergone electroshock and maybe understand that you weren't so alone in this?
Well, I when I first got out of the hospital, I told my family, who didn't believe me, and also discussed it. I was very, very upset when I got out because of how I'd been treated. The overall program was custodial care. Most of the time, you just sat around and you did nothing. And I was very mad about it, and I had to really work hard to get out of there. And while I was at the hospital, I went to summer school and proved I could do it. And then my mother died, and there was a delay in getting me out because of that. And finally, I got to go home 4 days a week for tutoring, and I was released after that when I showed I could do it. And when I got back, of course, I was just extremely angry, as many people who've been deprived and traumatized are. And people just more or less blew me off if I discussed it with one of the kids I knew at school. They didn't want anything to do with me anymore, and my family said I should be grateful I got so much help, and it was just the state hospitals were wonderful. And so gradually I just shut up. And then when I got my master's degree and my jobs, I decided it wasn't worth the risk because of how mentally ill were seen back then. And I think if I had been more open and tried to discuss it, I would have been told more or less the same thing. I was making it up, that this could never have happened, that the doctors are wonderful, and so on. So really, it wasn't until after I retired in 2009 and I discovered Deborah's group online, ECT Justice, that I told anyone what was going on. I think things are a little bit different now. There's more of a hospitable climate towards people who have LGBT and a variety of handicapping conditions or histories. And then I have not very much to lose. Who's going to do anything to me now? Mm-hmm. I'm not working for anybody. Nobody has that kind of power to do anything to me. So I want to see something done about all of this. And it's just, as I say, just a really awful situation. And the research that has been done to date has showed that ECT really doesn't work very well. And the Federal Drug Administration said in their report on ECT, which is dated 2016, that there is no proof that it works beyond a month. It does not work for schizophrenia, catatonia, or anything except a major depression and possibly bipolar disorder, and that's limited to a month. And there's been no follow-up on the many anecdotal reports they receive of brain dysfunction and disability, and yet they're going on with it, and it's a very lucrative thing. And Medicaid and Medicare pay for it in this country, and many insurance companies will pay for it. And yet there's so many reasons that it shouldn't be going on.
Mm-hmm. Listen up, we've got a couple more callers. Let's first go to Brian. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi, I have been listening to your conversation today, and I'm one of these homeless mental patients that people talk about on the radio sometimes. And I hear you discussing the problems in the mental health care system, and I almost wish you'd stop, because I really feel like you're confused. And I don't want to be confrontational. I know that what is being presented as psychiatric care has helped some people, but for the vast majority of people, what is being done is not helpful. They're wrong with their diagnosis 60% of the time, and although medications are not used properly, they are absolutely essential for people with severe mental illnesses like bipolar and schizophrenia. Better education about medications and better protection of the patient is essential, though. There are a dozen agencies that are supposed to help me get my mental health care, and you can't find them, you can't access them, and if you do, you're told that they don't have the budget to help. A recent example is that I was just sitting in a doctor's office, a general practitioner, shaking uncontrollably because I had been refused appropriate medical care by a psychiatrist at the VA. At the same time I was sitting there shaking, holding myself and rocking uncontrollably, the VA was telling me, "We've done everything on our checklist of things to do, therefore you have received mental health care and you're fine now." That happens all the time. The standard of care is so bad. 80% of the money, in my estimation, spent on mental health care is wasted. Mm-hmm. And I really wish someone would look into that. And I'll take any comments off the air. Sorry for rambling. I'm a mental patient. Bye.
Thank you for the call.
No, it's all good, man. It's important to hear. I mean, we obviously, you know, this is a big subject. We're actually talking about maybe making this a more regular thing on Wednesday Talk Radio once a month. We'll see how that goes. But yeah, there's so many people suffering, and David and I have had our own, I think, briefer experiences, touches with the difficulties, major difficulties in our own mental health, and that's why we're both interested in this issue. But there is, I count myself lucky. I think perhaps David
also
does too, because
yes.
You know, the people like the caller have been obviously struggling for quite a bit longer, and the help that is offered in this dog eat dog world is woefully insufficient. We're specifically talking this morning about...
Could I say one
yeah,
more
go
thing
ahead.
About
Sorry,
the college
David.
Call? Yeah. So, Rethinking Psychiatry, we're about exploring options. I think we don't have any lengthy dogma, but we're kind of a forum for people who are concerned about the system to discuss it and learn about alternatives and present those alternatives in these monthly events and educate ourselves and the public about these options. And so options, alternatives, that's kind of the theme, as opposed to force, right? So if you, caller, have found, the medications you're taking helpful, more power to you. But my experience in a very brief incident, being held a few days and forcibly drugged, was the worst experience of my life. I mean, it was the most horrifying thing. It was like a chemical rape to have people force me to take something that was, you know, making me feel like a zombie, shutting down my neurochemistry. But that's how the system runs. It's run as if a doctor, so-called, or a person can tell you what's good for you. And all too often, what they claim is good for you is really what's good for the system. It's good for the nurses. To sum it up a little short, but I would say basically in hospitals, in my observation and also reading, success is you shut people up. Oh, now they're better. They shut up. They're happily smiling in a daze. Wow, they're so much better. It's not really about finding out what works for the patient. It's what makes people docile.
And we all would like to think that things have changed since the days of the first caller, Sean, talked about the idea of the snake pit, the mental institution where people are like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which were basically shut down. And then there was supposed to be this transition into community mental health. And then, Reaganism came in and put a dash to that. So the whole structure that was supposed to be put in place to replace that never came into being, and which is why one of the reasons why people are just shunted into jail or out onto the street.
I can't really comment. I mean, I haven't studied closely how bad hold you by force hospitals are now compared to back then, but they still exist. It's still people. I mean, I had a friend who was in the state hospital and had to have a two-day administrative trial to avoid getting the worst so-called antipsychotic drugs forcibly administered to this person. And this is a gentle, soft-spoken, thoughtful guy. That was in the Oregon State Hospital here just a few years ago. So, yeah, maybe things have improved. I don't know, but they're still so bad that there's still snake pits of a sort.
Right. Yeah, I didn't mean to say that. Because yeah, that's the I guess there's so many layers of confusion or lack of good understanding, but yeah, obviously that there are still hospitals. I guess the big huge, where everybody was sort of dumped. I guess that's sort of gone away.
No, I don't think so.
But not completely.
No, that's Oregon State Hospital, Washington, whatever it's called, State Hospital. They're big. Prison-like institutions, not with cells per se, but people are held there and they're forcibly drugged.
I got to change this mental narrative in my mind.
I'm not
no,
familiar,
true.
How it's so wonderfully better. It's not clear to
no,
me.
No, I wasn't saying it was better.
Well,
there's
this narrative out there that maybe things have gotten so much better. Well, I'm not clear at all that has happened.
No, all I was saying is there was a phase where a lot of hospitals were
closed. That's true.
And there was supposed to be this transition of community
right,
mental
no,
health.
And that didn't.
And that
indeed,
never happened.
Indeed.
But there are still big hospitals. So anyway, let's go to our next caller. Harry, go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, greetings, everyone. And thank you for taking my call. And thank you for KABU and you, Paul, for bringing up this subject. I remember about 2 years ago you brought up this subject when they had demonstrations at Kaiser Permanente, and I realized that Kaiser Permanente were doing these shock therapy. It was unbelievable. I belonged to Kaiser for all my life, and they were always considered progressive type of medical institution. And I was just shocked that they finding out they're still doing this, and it's all over the country. But they've been doing it for years. You would think that they would have collected all the data and find out, hey, does this work or not? Putting electricity through someone's brain and would cause some damage. I could see maybe doing it just once to see if it would help. But the gentleman that's on your program said it only lasts for a month. So that means what? It doesn't work, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, so Michael, would you like to respond to that? Michael?
It's not what I'm saying. It's what the Federal Drug Administration is saying.
Also, in the UK, John, actually he's from New Zealand, John has done, son is on long-term mental health outcomes following electroshock. And actually, there's very few studies, and his conclusion was that it doesn't work, and it has no place today when we have a scientific evidence-based medical practice. For instance, you would not want to take an antibiotic that has not been tested and has not been followed for its side effects. So what is going on is that practitioners use their own judgment instead of research or the science or the warnings of the FDA, which I would say are of overwhelming significance. And to speak frankly, a lot of them probably just do it for the money. They can charge more for a electric shock treatment. We probably wouldn't believe how much they charge for something like that than for medication, which is much less dangerous. If you have side effects from medication, it can usually be discontinued, except when they build up subtly, as they do in tardive dyskinesia. And it's not until years and years after you start taking the medication that the problem becomes apparent. So, you know, it's a horrible situation. However, in Oregon, electroshock is now prohibited in public institutions. And this is the state, of course, where Cuckoo's Nest was filmed in 1974-75. Where they showed this horrific electroshock scene that shocked the nation, and also in Arizona, and there are four states that prohibit electroshock in children, which are Texas, California, Tennessee, and Colorado, and most of the others require informed consent, although that's at the doctor's discretion. It may not include information on long-term brain damage. And also some states allow minors to appeal their doctor's decision to administer electroshock, such as Michigan. So things have changed, but of course not enough. And there still can be a involuntary administration of medication, but that's only in cases where there's imminent danger of harm to self or others, and patients do have the legal right to refuse to take medication. Of course, that's not always the best decision if they are very sick.
And of course, this this lawsuit that we're talking about and that's going to be discussed this evening, again at the Rethinking Psychiatry event at Montevilla United Methodist Church at 7, is a shot across the bow, I believe. Is a, let me just read another paragraph. An assembled cast, and this is from Peter Bragan's article about this lawsuit, an assembled cast of accomplished experts in the industry all stepped up to support the ECT plaintiffs, including the single most compelling and critical ECT psychiatrist in the country, the ex-director of the FDA, the author of the ECT FDA citizen petition, and the preeminent NASA JPL, that's a Jet Propulsion Laboratory electrical engineer. Plaintiffs were surrounded by some of the greatest experts anywhere, all testifying on behalf of the ECT manufacturer that violated... wait a second. I think I'm missing something. This anyway, this was a major case because there is a... Okay, so these were actually in support of the plaintiffs in this lawsuit. I thought it was the other way around. Okay, never mind. So this is from Peter Bragan, huge breakthrough in lawsuits against manufacturers ECT shock device. I guess my point is that this is going to be felt throughout the industry if this, you know, they had to settle. It didn't go to a jury trial. Obviously, they settled because they were worried that the jury trial was going to go against them. And he says that a lot of evidence came out that in the discovery process through this trial that is going to be really helpful to future cases. All right, it's 9:15 in the morning. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm your host, Paul Rowland. I'm in the studio with David Potter with Rethinking Psychiatry. I'm on the phone with Michael Sturman, an electroshock survivor who's going to be speaking this evening at this event with Rethinking Psychiatry. I want to tell you what's coming up this morning on KBOO. Next, at 9 on Politics of Living, is a look at traditional versus non-traditional holiday celebrations. At 10, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, the Bike Show brings you news and views of cycling in Oregon and beyond. All these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you have not yet but would like to become a member, feel free to go to kboo.fm and click on Donate. And we've just got a few minutes left. We don't have any callers right now. It doesn't look like. Oh, we do have a caller. Jeremy, you're on the air.
Hi. I got really upset there when you said it doesn't look like we have any callers. Because anyway, I've been waiting a long time.
Sorry, the screen went blank momentarily. Go ahead.
Yeah, a couple of things. Just there's a confusion as to how many people are in hospital now as opposed to previously. There's a significantly lower state hospital population, but David Potter's absolutely correct in saying that that doesn't mean that there's not big hospitals locking people up against their will and committing what is legally understood as assault and battery upon them. Attempts to enhance an inmate, which is how I understood my own mental hospitalization. I was never a patient. Actually, I was a patient, but in retrospect, I was an inmate. Right to refuse drugs or shock. Bringing someone into custody against their will is understood as an illegal detention, legally speaking, and then to shove a needle in them or strap electrodes under their head can be understood as assault and battery. But unfortunately, you know, no one ever gets to sue for that. They just very slowly ex-inmates have established the right to refuse some of these things, although it's not particularly well developed, because what psychiatrists have maintained is that people are being dangerous to themselves or to others by refusing these treatments. And I'm sorry, I forget the name of your other guest, the one on the phone, Michael. He just said that it might not be a good idea for some people to refuse drugs if they're very sick. And that with that, I'd like to raise my big question, which is, if you break a bone and present yourself at the emergency room, they use a diagnostic test, which is scientifically valid, which is they take an X-ray and they see an aberrant musculoskeletal issue, and then they can remediate that. It's the analogy is, can you break your bone? On the other hand, and this is not an original thought, I think there are a whole lot of people who are asking for, and in some ways very rarely receiving, an appropriate response to the fact that they're in emotional distress. I don't think this is biochemically driven. I think it's you know, I mean, we're a miserable society. We drive a lot of people crazy. But I think it's not unreasonable for the society to have some sort of response to that. And it sounds like Lapland's got it figured out, and we sure don't. But I would argue with Michael at the idea of people being sick mentally and thereby needing, quote, medication. This drives right into the particularly ugly paradigm of the last 40 years since they started pushing Prozac, which is that people have some sort of serotonin imbalance or you know, manic depressives, which I believe Michael also said are particularly well responsive to electroshock. Well, I came within an inch. I was diagnosed manic depressive and schizophrenic at one point, and I came within an inch of getting shocked. And I feel that I really dodged the bullet there. The best reference I've ever heard to how electroshock works is, if you hit someone on the head with a sledgehammer, they'll probably forget how miserable they are for a short amount of time.
Yeah, I think that's a really very good analogy.
Well, let's let
and 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 anyway, I'd like Michael to respond to the idea that maybe no one should ever get this. Maybe it should be illegal to stick electrodes on somebody's head. And maybe it should be illegal to forcibly drug anybody, because it really is assault and battery to invade their body with some chemical. Now, if people are...
Well, we're running out of time. Maybe
I've run on.
Okay, no, it's okay. I just want to also admonish you. There's certain words you can't say on the air. I had to...
I rarely get through a call-in without...
I had to press the dump button so people actually lost some of what you said. That's the negative part of using those words, because we have problems with the FCC otherwise. Anyway, so thank you for calling. Michael, would you like to respond to what he had to say?
Well, the way I look at it is what works for the individual. And it may be that medications work. I'm against shock treatments. I won't say that works for manic depression or anything else. But if I looked up the Oregon statutes on electroshock, also all of those were 50 states and District of Columbia and Puerto Rico. And in Oregon, electroshock is banned in public institutions. So there should be no more cuckoo's nests. Of course, whether the state hospital is obeying the law or certain practitioners are obeying the law is a different story. And the same is true of forced drugging. And there are certain individuals who have a mental illness who get out of control because of their illness. And in those situations, it's legally to force drugs on them. Otherwise, my understanding, it isn't. Of course, what really happens is perhaps a entirely different story. And it's known that practitioners often lie about situations, and they will make up things and force things on people which they really shouldn't. But again, it's really what works for the individual. If somebody is taking drugs and they have relief, there are many people who swear by these drugs. Fine. If someone doesn't like the drugs, and what has recently come up is that there's a very large portion of, not very large, but a portion of people who have the most severe mental illness, schizophrenia or manic depression, who do well without drugs. And this has been shown especially in the Scandinavian countries, as you mentioned. So,
We're almost out of time here. I just wanted to respond briefly to Jeremy's point. I know David probably has a lot to say on this, that the whole a broader question of, you know, whether, you know, what the status of mental illness, whether it's, you know, you can make an analogy to physical injuries or illness, and that's a big question. I know that it's probably a lively one within Rethinking Psychiatry, I imagine.
Well, I don't know. We generally are busy organizing events as opposed to having long philosophical arguments, but I'd love to. I'm always up for that, and I'm glad to be able to talk here. Let's see. So
let's go to our next caller. We're almost out of time here. We only have a couple minutes. So let's go to Brandon. You're going to have to be our last caller. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey there. Just about ready to walk into work really quick. Just one thing. I know there's a lot of psychedelic research studies in the last like 20 years or 10 years. It's got a big revival recently. I know MAPS is an awesome website, MAPS.org, Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. I'm not an expert in mental health, but I do know that psychedelics are, you know, opening new doors in treatment for depression and PTSD. And there is a measure coming up in 2020 in Oregon to legalize psilocybin, and so I'm hoping that that can, maybe break down the law a little bit in Oregon for more psychedelic research. And I know that's something that needs, I think, 140,000 signatures on, and it's coming up pretty soon. So,
okay, well, that's a
Kehu could
That'll be a subject for a future show for sure.
Oh,
I'm
awesome.
I went to the Portland Psychedelic Society conference recently. It was actually really amazing, and there has some really incredible research that's been being done, opened up over the past 10, 15 years. And lots of breakthroughs. So yeah, I'll be covering that. Thank you for flagging that. A little bit off our topic, I just want to remind people, putting a stop to shock, a major legal victory this evening, 7 p.m., Montevilla United Methodist Church, 232 Southeast 80th Avenue. Come and find out all about this.
Well, go briefly, ahead. That's just a few blocks from the Academy Theater. It's a landmark that people can
indeed
put it in their brain, you know, oh, that's where that is. So
my neighborhood.
Yeah.
Well, Michael, any last thoughts for our listeners about anything that you've heard or that's come up for you?
Well, I don't know anything about psychedelics. I understand that their use in psychiatry is experimental still. But despite all I've said about the problems, there is good treatment available. You often have to shop around for it and find out somebody who is reputed to be good. And you have to make a special effort to stay away from shock doctors or doctors with acidic personalities and those who would do you harm.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, and we'll see you this evening up here in Portland. David, any last words about rethinking psychiatry or anything else?
We're a growing project. This is a growing movement. I encourage people to get involved. And we're in favor of informed choices, you know, not only with regard to electroshock, but drugs also. You know, people should know that taking a lot of heavy psychiatric medication can take 20 to 25 years off someone's life due to the toxic nature of these drugs. So that should, you know, people should definitely be informed, and they should have the choice before ingesting or injecting toxic substances.
Okay, well, we got to get out of here, but you can find out more about Rethinking Psychiatry, about the event this evening, and get involved if you want at kbo.fm Wednesday Talk Radio. And thank you so much for listening. Thank you, David. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
Paul Rowland, be with you next week.
Talk about destruction.